Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, droughts all over the world are driving up food prices and costing jobs as farmers are forced to cut crops from water shortages. Then, a conversation between four Nobel Prize-winning scientists about science and society, the importance of public education, and reversing some disturbing trends in our education system. All over the world, droughts are escalating food prices and diminishing jobs as farmers are forced to cut yields from water shortages. Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, Brazil, and the Western U.S. all face water stress. In California, where the entire state faces drought, some 800,000 acres of farmland have remained idle, which has cost 20,000 jobs. That is the equivalent of 1,250 square miles. Lynn Ingram joins us now. She's a professor of Earth and Planetary Science and Geography and the director of the Laboratory for Environmental and Sedimentary Isotope Geochemistry at the University of California at Berkeley. She's also the author of the book, The West Without Water. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Lynn Ingram. It's great to have you here with us.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Your book warns us of what we're facing with regards to water in both the coming days and years. I wonder if we could start with the scope of the situation.
Actually, for the past 3 years in California, we've had pretty low precipitation, and this year in particular, one of the worst on record. We did have a few storms, so now we're up to maybe 40-60% average. But the long term is what we're worried about in terms of supporting a growing population, agriculture that uses 80% of our water, and our environment is suffering. We have aquatic ecosystems that are really declining. And so it just looks like, in terms of the future, and also we have groundwater levels dropping. You know, so we've been using up all our sort of stored water as well. And so in terms of the big picture, the 20th century looks like it was somewhat wetter than average when viewed over a couple thousand years. And we may be heading back into a naturally, you know, sort of drier period anyway. But then if you add on global warming, which, you know, will probably cause the region to dry even further, you know, we're heading into a pretty severely dry period in the future.
We've been reading quite a bit in the news about what that might actually mean. Some of the problems, of course, are particularly tied to our food.
Right, because agriculture uses 80% of all the developed water. And so this year some farmers have gotten no allocation of water. So they're drawing on groundwater, and then the groundwater levels are dropping, the water table. You know, it's already, I think, for the farmers, like heading into a crisis situation.
Your book also talked a bit about how we're dealing with a problem also from things like salinity and with rising sea levels. How do those two things combine to create more problems?
So in the sort of hub of California's water system is San Francisco Bay and Delta. And what we've seen by looking at taking cores from the bay from the past, that during periods of drought, the bay and delta naturally get drier or get saltier. But of course, now we're diverting water away for cities and agriculture. So the delta and the bay are getting steadily saltier from that. And then on top of that, we have sea level rise that's going to cause more salty water to come into the bay and delta through the Golden Gate from the Pacific Ocean. And the delta is where the big pumps are, where water is taken out for the farmers down south and for Southern Cal, for Los Angeles and San Diego area.
What if it's saltier? What are the impacts?
For the drinking water, it's not good, because then it becomes undrinkable. But then the other impacts are to the aquatic ecosystem. So there's certain fish going through there or various species that live in the delta that really require fresher water to survive. If it gets saltier and saltier, it's going to become an environment where they can't live. So we're threatening the ecosystems, and then also the surrounding marshes will probably change and the fresher species like the tule grass won't be able to survive. So the natural environment will be impacted, as well as drinking water and agricultural water.
This is not uniquely a California problem. We have just in the U.S., the entire West is considered to be in a drought, but not even just in the U.S. Australia, Singapore, Brazil, I think Malaysia are all facing serious water stresses. This looks to be a global problem.
Yeah, and also parts of the Mediterranean, Spain, Portugal, areas like that are getting drier, warmer and drier. Yeah, Australia is just coming out of a 10-year drought. They had to pretty much resort to pretty strong measures. They've decreased their water usage by, I think, 35% through recycling of wastewater, switching to water-efficient appliances, and they built desalination plants in all their coastal cities. So, you know, they've really had to adapt to a drier conditions.
Does it look like this is going to get worse with climate change and with an increase in population? I think the United Nations has said we're going to have something like 9 billion people by 2050.
California is projected to grow to 50 million by 2050. And the projections in terms of as you increase warming in the future, you know, it's definitely going to continue to get drier, more wildfire, and our snowpack has also been steadily declining, and we really rely on that snowpack. You know, we have the dry season during the summer that, you know, the environment and everybody relies on that snowmelt. You know, with warming, you're going to just have less precipitation falling as snow and more falling as rain during the winter. So that natural reservoir for the dry season won't be there as much. So I think it is going to continue, but if we can kind of follow the example of Australia in terms of really taking it seriously and really starting some of these uses of gray water and recycling, storing water in underground aquifers during wet years, because we'll have some wet years. It's not like it's going to be uniformly dry, but, you know, to really try to harness that water and store it underground, doing all the things they've done, I think we can, you know, we have a good chance of adapting to the drier conditions.
Let's look now more at what your book also traced, your book, The West Without Water. Put this in the long-term historic perspective, like the Earth's life. You found that really the Earth has this historic swing from an ice age to an interglacial period, which are, you said, generally shorter and more like aberrations. What can we learn when we look at the entire history of the Earth in terms of our future?
We definitely see that there's big swings in warm and cool, as well as wetter and drier. And we see these cycles, it seems to be tied to conditions over the Pacific Ocean, these cycles of 30 to 70 year wet and dry, and then we see a 200 year cycle and so on. And I think just the fact that you do see these larger wet and dry cycles means we can't really count on even what we had in the entire 20th century looks like it was on the wetter end of the cycle. So we, even if you don't think that global warming is going to impact our water, we naturally seem to be heading back into a drier part of the cycle. And we just have to prepare for using less water, which we can do. And there's a lot of room for improvement.
One of the things I found fascinating about your book was explaining how scientists can read a history through the natural materials like stones and trees and ice and wildfires. How do these stones and trees and ice help us explain the climate and the drought of the past?
That's a good point, that we only have instrumental records where humans are measuring maybe back 100, 150 years at the most. So that's what, you know, when you get into this field of paleoclimatology, we have to look at the natural climate archives. We've used lakes. There's lakes that will get larger during wetter centuries or wetter decades, and then they shrink during drier times as evaporation is larger than inflow. Another one would be tree rings. By looking at the growth rings in tree trunks, you can see, you know, you have to pick the trees right and which ones respond to precipitation. And the ones that put on a wider ring during a wetter year, for instance, versus a narrower ring. And then the one that in our lab we do is looking at sediment cores from various places like lakes, and we've looked in San Francisco Bay because the salinity of the bay, as I was mentioning before, varies depending on how much fresh water is draining its watershed. And the watershed for the bay covers 40% of California. So, say during a big drought, you're going to see the bay is going to get saltier, and you can look at the fossil evidence in the sediment cores that are the sediments accumulating at the bottom of San Francisco Bay, and those give you a measure of how salty the bay was in the past. So, you know, it's just a matter of using our creativity and then testing it, looking at modern conditions and how that is recorded in all these various climate proxies. And then we take that back, going back hundreds to thousands of years, to try to kind of piece together what the climate was like.
We know historically people have moved to areas because conditions like ample water essentially invited them, and then the area would dry up. What generally happens in those situations, and what examples do you have of those?
We've looked at the archaeological records and seen, for instance, in the Four Corners, and this is not my own work, but the archaeologists have seen that there were, like, the Anasazi populations that lived there for 1,000 years when there was ample water, and then during the medieval period, 900 to 1400 AD, we entered a really dry period, and there was abandonment of these sites and evidence that there was increased violence and malnutrition and things like that. It just caused more conflict and competition between those populations. That's what can happen when it gets very dry.
So the scarcity then is perhaps generating what people talk about in today's concern of a potential water war.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we have our own version of that, starting with agriculture versus the aquatic ecosystems in the Delta and Bay. That's one example. It's just locally where we're going to see, once there's water scarcity, then there's just that competition for what little water we have.
When an area like California dries up, who feeds the rest of the country?
Right, because, you know, we produce a large, I think it's something like $45 billion a year industry in California that, for instance, we produce something like 80% of the world's almonds. It would have a big effect, just not just in California, but outside of California.
Your last section of your book talks about how societies need to address these problems of drought. Let's move to this. What would you say are the most important adjustments that we need to be considering today as a society or as a humanity?
One thing for sure is starting to value water and its scarcity and its importance to both human and other life. Water is so cheap in our state, and it appears so plentiful because all we do is turn on the faucet. You know, I think a lot of people don't have an understanding of where their water comes from and what's really happening with the groundwater. You know, we're pretty much depleting this huge aquifer. And so more education and more understanding that can then lead to ways of getting into the recycling and reusing gray water. And I've seen other things where people can harvest rainwater in your home and store water in tanks. There's all kinds of things that we can all start doing. So if we do head into a drought, we're prepared. I think getting prepared and really having a full understanding of the water situation.
As a scientist who has really looked at this from the grand history of planet Earth, if you were going to say the top few lessons that you've drawn from this big history that we should be applying today, that we should understand today, what would you say those are?
And if you really look at the big picture, you can see that the climate's anything but constant. I mean, it's extremely variable and in some ways unpredictable, although if I think having that perspective of seeing how variable it is gets you in the mind frame that, you know, you can't just assume that that things are going to always stay the same. And there's also the other side of the coin, which we write about in the book, which is the flooding side. And that we're not really prepared for that either, because We're expanding into the Central Valley cities, and the population is like 6 million there, and that was under 10 feet of water during the 1861 flood, which was historic. We have historic records of that flood. And if we look back, we see that those happened every 1 to 200 years. So it just seems like looking at the big picture, you can really prepare for, and just like with earthquakes, you know, people can just be ready for something, some big event that might happen.
Do you think that having some kind of international agreement on water might be important?
I think anything that can really start to treat water like it's got to be our most important resource. It's just so important for everyone to value water and ensure that everyone has enough water that's clean. There's people in the Central Valley that have to use groundwater that's been polluted by agriculture. So I think that also water sanitation and cleanliness and ensuring that everyone has enough water just to live is really important.
Lynn Ingram, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lynn Ingram is a professor of Earth and Planetary Science and Geography and the director of the Laboratory for Environmental and Sedimentary Isotope Geochemistry at the University of California at Berkeley. She's also the author of the book, The West Without Water. When we come back, four Nobel Prize-winning scientists discussing science and society and the importance of public education in the U.S. Stay tuned.
Well, Bohemoth calls it his own, while the hammer wanders alone. They both go out to play on that cold and rainy day. And Bohemoth sings us his song, while the hammer wanders along. But in the glory of this spring, you can hear the hammer sing.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Earlier this month, the University of California at Berkeley hosted a discussion between four Nobel Prize-winning scientists about the importance of public education and of reversing some disturbing trends in the education system. They included Randy Scheckman, who is a professor of molecular and cell biology, who won the 2013 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine for his role in revealing the machinery that regulates the transport and secretion of protein in our cells. The discovery led to mass production of valuable drugs, including insulin, for treatment of diabetes. Saul Perlmutter is professor of physics and faculty senior scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and he led one of two teams that simultaneously discovered the accelerating expansion of the universe and was awarded the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics. George Smoot is a professor of physics and an astrophysicist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He led a team that obtained the first images of the infant universe, findings that confirmed the prediction of the Big Bang theory. He won the 2008 Nobel Prize in Physics. Daniel McFadden is a professor of economics. He won the 2000 Nobel Prize in Economics for his development of statistical methods that related to economic theory of discrete choice. His research changed the economic theory connected to both individual decision-making and large-scale public policy.
The following panel was moderated by UC Berkeley's Chancellor, Nicholas B. Dirks.
Thank you all, and thanks to everyone here, and joining me will be a few of our most distinguished professors, all Nobel laureates, who have been honored for their extraordinary work in expanding the boundaries of knowledge and understanding in their respective fields. Ladies and gentlemen, Randy Scheckman, Daniel McFadden, George Smoot, and Saul Perlmutter. Let's begin with the question around the place of public higher education in the nation today. As you know, there has been growing critique of public institutions, even of the idea of public mission. There's a concern at the same time that higher education no longer serves something that we might call the public good. At best, it serves a private good. So my question for you, why have you, scholars at the very, very top of your fields, chosen to commit your lives to public higher education? Maybe we'll start with you, Randy.
Well, Chancellor, thanks for the question. I'm a creature of the University of California. I was an undergraduate at UCLA. I was a postdoctoral fellow at UCSD. I confess that I spent 4 years at Stanford, but I've been here for 38 years. So I feel very strongly about public higher education. It really has made the difference in my life. When I started in 1966 at UCLA, the tuition was $40 a term, the room and board was $400 a term. I could work a summer job and pay for the whole year. Obviously, that is no longer possible, and I think that's a tragedy because 70% of the young kids in this country go to public institutions, and it has turned from what used to be an investment in the future into a private commodity that forces people to go into debt. I think that's tragic because public institutions like Berkeley are the engine of social change. So we really need to strengthen that model going forward.
I had a different history. I went to MIT, undergraduate and graduate, and I also worked a summer job. My parents put up half the money, and I still didn't have enough to get through past the first year, and so I kept working. And that's a huge difference between the private sector and the public sector, especially in those days. But the primary reason I picked to come to Berkeley was it was a premier institution. It was a great place to do research. And so for me, the public education part is a bonus to the fact that it's an outstanding place. And the key issue is to be both public education and really the best.
How does that change things, perhaps, from your experiences in private institutions? Are they really different? Is this institution different because it is public? Saul?
My experience was I was an undergraduate at Harvard University, and I came here as a graduate student. I think that the part that struck me and has struck me, and I'm not positive how much of it is because it's a public institution, but I think there's part of this, is that there's a very, very much a non-hierarchical feeling at Berkeley. So as a young graduate student and a young postdoc, your ideas get pulled in and used, and I think that there's a much more of a reaching out to include the whole community at all levels without very much of a sense of, you know, who's the lead professor and who's the undergraduate in a research group. Everybody's working together. And I think that that feel is something that comes a little bit because of this long sort of democratic tradition of a public university. I mean, I'd be curious actually to hear other people's thoughts about that, but it has that feel to it.
Dan?
Well, I grew up in the rural South in a family of limited means, and I financed my first year in a public university by selling one cow. And by the way, I would like to see us return to a one cow benchmark for college tuition. I taught in both private universities, MIT, Caltech, as well as here at Berkeley. And I think the exciting thing about Berkeley is that it's so open and the student body is so diverse and there's so many opportunities that all of these great institutions, there's no substitution for the kind of diversity and opportunity that a place like Berkeley offers.
I'd like to ask a question now about the relationship between applied and basic research in all of your different fields. Even as there's a growing critique, I think, of the public good, there's growing emphasis on application, on usable knowledge, on things that have direct and immediate utility in some kind of way. So I'd like to ask you, even though you've all worked in some ways across basic and applied fields, what is it about basic research that is so fundamental? Why is it that we should support basic research?
I think that the things that George and I have done are clearly in the basic research category. It's very hard to make a direct statement that, you know, if we understood better how the distant universe works, it will impact our lives today. On the other hand, it seems that there's something, to me, almost magical about the way in which we've developed, you know, as civilizations over time, that when you try to attack these very almost poetic fundamental questions, it seems to bring out the most inventive in our societies. And it's led, I think, to these amazingly practical developments that you would never set out to build a better printer by inventing the laser. And yet, the fundamental questions that you're asking when you invent a laser somehow end up providing you the way of doing something very practical, like all the things that we now, the modern day world, uses a laser for. You know, Einstein's theory of general relativity seems to have, you know, why would it matter what happens to time as you move a clock nearer to the speed of light? And yet, if you don't know how that works and you don't understand general relativity, we would not be able to have the accuracy of the GPS satellite locators that we have today. So in the end of the day, I just always come back to this idea that you do it in some sense because it's this aspirational goal of humans to ask questions that move them in some deep way. And that bonus is that it's also, it seems to be the way that we make very practical advances in our, you know, societies and our economics.
I think there's an intimate connection between applied and basic research. The observations, the puzzles that we face in terms of applied work raise questions about the underlying sources of these problems. And if you understand the underlying sources, you begin to see how to solve the puzzles. It's certainly been true in my work, for example, where it was a very applied problem that motivated my work, which relied heavily on developments in mathematics and psychology, as well as economics.
Randy, one.
Yes, in the life sciences, there are enormous practical applications of the basic knowledge that my colleagues and I have discovered here at Cal. I'll give you one terrific example. A colleague in the immunology division of my department was studying how immune cells are regulated in the way they attack tumors. And he found a way of unleashing the power of T cells in attacking tumors with a simple treatment that worked in animals. He was then able to take this to a biotech company and eventually to the clinic. And several years ago, it was approved as the first very effective immune therapy for melanoma, for which there was no effective treatment or cure. And yet, with his discovery at a very basic level, now a good fraction of patients who would otherwise have succumbed to melanoma can be effectively cured. This all comes from basic discoveries of how cells and organisms work. And it does not come, in my opinion, when the work is directed in a top-down manner to try to find with a particular goal in mind. What we're most effective at here at this institution is understanding the fundamental laws of nature. And that's really the kind of work that I feel strongly we should support here.
I'll try and keep it short because this is actually an interesting and complex question. Yeah. Why people do these kinds of research. Some people just want to know how things work. Some people want to do something that's important. Some people want to, you know, solve a particular problem, depending on what their motivation were. But what we have seen is all the really transformative changes in our lives have come from basic research, where something came completely out of left field that no one expected. You were doing research for something else, and you discovered this principle, and it comes to do that. And so the example that I've given before is a little over 100 years ago, we discovered the electron, and almost 65% of the economy of the world is manipulating, moving electrons around. That's all you guys do, right? Store information is sending electrons from one place to another and telling him to do stuff. Even your body is moving electrons around to do chemistry. So who would have ever paid for Thomson to do research in discovering whether it was an electron or not, right? It wouldn't have been motivated. Only after you make the discovery, you suddenly have TV, you suddenly have all those other things. Sometimes answering a fundamental question tells you how things fit together. Sometimes they lead to tremendous transformation.
I want to shift a little bit to talk about the issue of collaboration. I spent a number of years at Columbia as a dean of the faculty. I used to evaluate faculty files, and sometimes you would get papers, whether in economics or physics, that would have 100 names attached to it. Now, this is a group that is associated with, and I am absolutely of that camp, with individual genius. But on the other hand, you all are part of a landscape in which we rely increasingly on collaboration. That's really part of how we can innovate, discover. Could you say something about how the nature of collaboration might have changed over the course of your careers?
When I started out as a graduate student, I worked on a large group of four people doing a major experiment. And now those same kinds of experiments are done with a few thousand people. And I moved from that field into a field which there were many smaller number of people, and now we're seeing large collaborations form in astrophysics and cosmology just because the problems we were attacking are much greater and we need bigger planet quality. What I find is as we move to more complex problems that you need people across disciplines first across disciplines in physics, now even from chemistry to physics or to biology to physics. We're integrating the knowledge a lot more. You need more expertise from a larger area because you're synthesizing much more.
So, personal history here at Cal. I was hired in 1976 to an outstanding biochemistry department. It was one of 16 different life science departments in the College of Letters and Sciences. Lots of little silos with very little interaction. And one of the important things that the man who hired me, Daniel Koshlin, did was to organize a major life science change that resulted in the fusion of a number of departments, and I think that's been much to our benefit because it brought together people with very different ideas in a more common element in the same department where they interacted with one another and they hadn't before.
My personal experience has been almost completely collaborative, and it's partly because I don't think the projects that we were doing could have been done by just, you know, one person by themselves. There's this myth of the lone scientist in a lab coat going off by themselves and coming out with the, you know, eureka, the answer. But my experience has been the exact opposite, and that the most pleasure I've had is, you know, give and take and social discussions of every good idea with around the table in a group meeting or all sorts of pairwise discussions and in a group. And, you know, I've been saying that if you really want to be a lone person, maybe go and be an artist. But if you want to really be a social person, you know, have a great time with a lot of other people in your work, just be a scientist. You know, it's a really place to be sociable.
It's a better social life.
Yeah. I was going to give a sort of a strange example. So recently I was involved in an interdisciplinary project that was art, computer science, and physics. The idea was to make a sculpture, which is now displayed in a museum, that's squaring the circle. So squaring the circle is a long historical problem that people realized you can't do that in a finite number of steps. People knew it was a difficult problem in the old days, but they used to represent in the medieval paintings a circle meant the divine or the infinite, right, and a square meant the man-made. If you actually remember the Viterbi man from Leonardo da Vinci, the human's the only one that touched both. He's touching the circle with one set of hands, he's touching the square with the other. And so it was a collaboration of computer science artists and physicists that ended up with this sculpture that when you shine the light, it goes up to this very complicated lens and shines on the circle, and the shadow is a square, right? And so it's not that spectacular, but it was fun.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I'd like to shift now to slightly more directed questions about the Nobel. Could you tell us some, at least, of the ways in which that phone call that came out here in California very early in the morning, how that changed your life?
Well, I would say that you become a savant on every subject, including things you know nothing about. So one of the difficulties is to avoid doing too many supermarket openings and to try to stick to the subjects you know. And of course, another challenge is for me, and I think for many others, is that it's not the end of your research career. Many of us want to go on working, and so you have to be careful to compartmentalize, keep the Nobel under control.
So it was about an hour after I got the phone call that I started having a third job, because teaching was a job and research was a job and being a Nobel laureate was a job. And the first thing was the director of LBL and the chancellor wanted to schedule at their convenient time a press conference, right? Which wasn't in those days good time because the East Coast wanted to go to press before that conference. So immediately you have to come in and do this event, and then the chancellor immediately scheduled me for three events because it was homecoming week. So I got dragged to homecoming to meet all the alumni, and they wanted to have a special dinner, and the dinner was during the time I was teaching one of the big courses I mentioned before. I was scheduling, you have to schedule the exams in the evening to get a lecture hall big enough. They wanted to have the dinner during the exam, but I had to finish making the exam for it. So that's just you suddenly get a new workload, and it takes a while. It took me more than a year to start being comfortable being a Nobel laureate, because I was getting all these emails saying, it's traditional that the new Nobel laureate does X, yeah, right? And you don't know whether it's traditional or not. You know, there's no handbook. I tried to get them to create a handbook on what to do, but even the Nobel Foundation, they have jobs for you.
Randy?
As you said, suddenly you're thrust on a stage that you didn't have before. Actually, I've used the opportunity to make very strong statements about public education and about scientific publication policies. And so I welcome that chance to say things that I used to say and no one would listen, and now suddenly. So actually, I've enjoyed that.
But Saul, has it also allowed you to venture further in your intellectual and scientific life?
In some ways, it's interesting because I think it makes it a little bit harder in your own original area, because in some sense, the people who already you were working with, they already knew you, and either they respected what you did or they didn't. It doesn't change whether you had a Nobel Prize. What it does do is allow you to actually start some conversations, outside your immediate close research area. It seems like if you're going to be asked to be an ambassador for science anyway, it does feel like it's a moment that you could try to ask some of the questions that you always were interested in asking. In my case, I've been interested in questions that have to do with what can we do to raise the general level of public discourse in our society. And now you have an easier time calling people up and talking to them who may want to work with you on something of that sort. So if you're forced to switch areas anyway for some of your time, ideally you can do something that you actually cared about doing at the same moment. I will say, though, that this issue of not having any handbook, I was starting to think about this. When you head out to Stockholm for the events that they organize for the Nobel Prize, it started to occur to me that we have to set up a Berkeley Nobel Laureates webpage just to keep track of what it was we figured out that you're supposed to be doing when you get there, since nobody tells you anything until, unless you get this background of a conversation. So it's great to win a Nobel Prize at Berkeley, because at least you have some people to talk to.
Indeed. But it's a major shift in life. Recently in the New York Times, there was a column by Nicholas Kristof who complained about the paucity of public intellectuals in American life. I think we have examples here of people who have been public intellectuals in all kinds of ways. But the Nobel does give you a kind of pulpit, a kind of platform on which to talk about issues of public importance, both with direct relevance and relationship to your own work, and in a much broader way. So what are some of the issues that you've turned to in your post-early AM phone call moment as a result, in part, of the kind of pull to a slightly more public intellectual position? Dan?
Well, I have certainly gotten involved heavily in the American healthcare system and working with Medicare and with the National Institute of Health on trying to sort out how our system works and how it can be improved, because there's a lot of room for improvement. And I have an opportunity to persuade occasionally people who are in policy-making positions to think through the economics of how this system is organized. And I would say that perhaps with the exception of the state of Georgia and Alabama, we are fairly persuasive.
George? I've got engaged a lot in public education. I realize it's really important to society and the world as a whole that there be people who are rational thinkers and are able to understand some of the global problems that we're facing and try and deal with them. But it's also just we need a lot of people who are technically capable of running society. And so I've been engaged in public education, sort of an outgrowth of having been in a public institution. So I've been engaged in a number of places. But the biggest effort, and sometimes the most scary effort, is Africa, where we're trying to do a lot of stuff. And I actually was friends with the head of Eutelsat, which does a lot of communication satellites, try and get them, convince them that they should beam some bandwidth down to Africa, which is their largest growing customer base for the future, to provide education, to get them access to the internet that most people don't have. Even if you have a cell phone, you don't really have much access So Africa is a very challenging place, but it's a continent that's actually desperately in need of education, desperately in need of technical capable people. And so we have a number of initiatives going on there, but it turns out to be much easier to do in developing countries than in countries that are pre-developing stage. Right?
Well, I've taken a very strong position on open access publication policies for the life science literature. And I used the occasion of my trip to Stockholm to write an editorial that was published in The Guardian that caused quite a stink. And so, although people who knew me knew that I had the same attitude on October 6th, suddenly after October 7th, by expressing these attitudes, it generates a lot more attention. And so I've exploited that attention to make the case for open access publication.
Saul?
I mentioned that I've been very interested in this question of what can you do to raise the general level of the public conversation, public discourse. So that's something that I've been trying to work in a number of different places, some foundations and National Academy of Science work. But the other role that you end up getting pulled into, and I'm imagining that this happens actually for a number of us, is the role of ambassador for science. So you're asked, and I've ended up going to Washington a number of times now to the Congress and the agencies, trying to make the case for why is it, I mean, it's basically that same question you asked at the very beginning of our conversation, right, about why is it that it's so important for our country to work on fundamental basic science when it you don't see it as the next immediate need that next year, and yet it's the place that it has to get done. It has to be done at a national scale. So I've ended up spending a lot of time on that as well.
Well, I'd like to use that to turn to the question of what are some of the most daunting challenges facing us as scientists and social scientists in terms of research support, certainly federal support, as well as state support, but also in terms of the political environment within which we work, the kind of support there is or isn't, as the case may be, for certain kinds of areas of exploration, the politicization of things as various as stem cell research or climate science or for that matter, healthcare. What are some of the things that you think we really have to worry about in terms of the contemporary landscape around the kind of research that you've been part of that has been, in our country, for the most part, very well supported, but which is now in some danger?
Maybe just to follow through a little bit on what I was just saying, my sense is that one of the reasons that I've been spending so much time in Washington these days is that we've seen, because of all the deadlock in Washington, it's hit science in a very odd way. When you have a stasis in Washington, when people are doing these sequesters and continuing resolutions for many years without a budget, in many areas of government, that just means that whatever was happening earlier continues to happen. But in sciences, it has a very strange effect because you can't continue to do whatever you were doing previously in the sciences and expect that to be good. You need to be able to move on to the next areas. And what it's meant is that almost all the large, exciting projects that I've been aware of that we were about to begin in the sciences in the United States basically were put on hold. And as I was saying, at some point, you know, there was no project that was too inexpensive for us to reject, and not to get started on. It's just been a period in which nothing's been moving ahead, and I see that as a serious threat to the ability of the United States to stay in the forefront as it has done for decades. If this political stalemate makes it impossible to actually move things forward, so that was a sort of unusual aspect of this particular political period.
In the 70 years since the Second World War, the United States has become a dominant player in the world, largely because of open immigration, easy transition of meritorious people from lower social economic groups into the mainstream. And that's fed a huge amount of innovation in this country. And I think the number of Nobel Prizes that have been collected by United States scholars is an indication of how effective that open system was. I think we're now in the danger of ossifying and closing down those roots for bringing in innovative people and giving them the opportunity. And I think that's perhaps the biggest challenge that we face in the coming decades, is to get our mojo back and get bright people moving up in the system and innovating.
We talked about public support, but of course there are other modes of supporting some of the science, some of the social science we do. I think that at Berkeley itself, more and more faculty are engaged in various kinds of private-public partnerships. There was another piece in the New York Times recently talking about the amount and the significance of private support through foundations for the sciences, and even some concern as to whether or not that would change the direction of science, although there were concerns after the war about whether the public interest in and state support for science would direct it towards particular outcomes like the Cold War ends and so on and so forth. Could you just say something perhaps about the world of private support?
So when we recruit a young scholar in the biomedical sciences at Berkeley, we used to rely on support from the state to help that individual set up his or her laboratory. But that's changed just in the last half dozen years, at the same time that it's incredibly expensive to set up a young investigator so that they can begin their their career, they're facing a difficult task getting federal support. And we, as an institution, as a public institution, have difficulty providing funds from the state for that purpose. And so there, at this point, is no substitute for private philanthropy to help us establish funds for endowed chairs and for the kind of equipment that a young scholar needs to get going when they can't rely on the state, when they can't rely on the federal government. They have to rely on this institution. And it's the friends and alumni of this institution that will bridge that gap going forward.
I mean, I agree. We're particularly, the public institutions are way more, you know, dependent upon partnership from the private sector, private donors, and foundations giving money to keep the quality of the place up and to be able to attract the talent. And it's clear, you know, we used to be very egalitarian when I first came to Berkeley. The idea that one professor would get a different salary than another wasn't taken very well. But now we depend on having chairs and being able to make offers and particularly getting startup money from whatever source we can. And that's critical to keep this the number one institution, right? If you don't have that, you just won't stay in the top level.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and you are listening to a conversation between four Nobel Prize-winning scientists about science and society and the importance of public education in the U.S.
So the time has come to have me ask some of the questions that have come in from you. Question from the floor. What do you think the future of public higher education holds for elevating the presence of women in the fields of science and mathematics?
So, this is a good question, because it's all men sitting up here.
We noticed.
Although when we go to some Nobel laureate meetings, there are some women, but there are not so many, and they tend to be in more concentrated in some fields than others. One of my heroes is Madame Curie, who managed to get two prizes in two different fields. So, in physics, there's a substantial number of undergraduates. There's slightly less graduate students. I was recruiting chair for a long time. We made a conscious effort to do that, and we had the advantage for two terms in a row. We had women chairs of the department, which was assigned to that. And so what we're seeing is it's balancing back up of women taking more of a role. But you have to realize all of us got the Nobel Prize for work we did like 15 years earlier. And so if some great woman researcher has made a great discovery, she probably won't get the prize for 15 more years. There's a big lag in the system, but I would not be surprised to see women at Berkeley get a Nobel Prize.
In economics, if you consider it a science,
dismal though it may be.
Dismal, at least. Over half of our graduate students are now women. We've also had some outstanding women on our faculty. Unfortunately, one of the problems with women is that if they're good, there are very many demands on their time. So our three most prestigious women faculty all have been in Washington at various times. Right now, Janet Yellen has just taken over the Federal Reserve. So we have a wealth of talent, and I think in the future we will see Nobel Prizes given to women in economics.
What one public policy action would you take to ensure that the U.S. still maintains the Nobel advantage 25 years from now? Randy.
One of the problems, and this addresses the question that was posed before, is not only the paralysis in our political system in funding, but it's also, I think, a bad trend in top-down management of science by administrators in Washington. The budget of the National Institutes of Health, which funds most biomedical science in this country, has dropped dramatically, and that, of course, is because of the political issue. But the problem is exacerbated by the leadership of the NIH, which wants to involve itself in top-down managing of our effort, and at the expense, I would say, of the curiosity-driven science that has powered us and, I think, of almost all Nobel laureates. I was amazed to read in the report Science: Endless Frontiers, written in the late 1940s by Vannevar Bush, that he, though he was a politician and an advisor to presidents, spoke very forcefully about the importance of basic investigator-initiated science and to the exclusion of government control of what we do. If we're going to continue this tremendous string of success we have in this country, it's going to be by continuing to invest at that level.
I have to chime in again. I spent a lot of time in other places around the world. And I have to say, when I look at it, I see the United States, North America have tremendous advantages. The U.S. has great demographics compared to many places in the world. It has a fundamentally strong economy, has a wonderful geographic position. It has a good culture to start with, although it's frayed around the edges. But in terms of making things go, what we're complaining about is that the rest of the people here, aren't paying attention to the fact that the world is changing and that we have to compete in a changing world, and we can't be paralyzed, and we do need to invest in education in order to be able to make the most of our talent, bringing in the very best people as an immigration issue, and really funding the fundamental research at a reasonable level with this degree of freedom. The importance of free, you know, having the, not your research directed, but actually choosing to do the right things is very important. If you screw up too many times, they don't fund you anymore, right? But they shouldn't stop you from pursuing something interesting.
Part of the genius of the American system of higher education is that we bring together different things that are in other systems kept apart. Teaching undergraduates, doing advanced research, thinking about preparation for careers, and thinking about the broad issues that are part of the liberal arts and sciences. This is a model now that is increasingly being copied in other parts of the world, not always successfully and not yet in ways that have really, for example, impacted the way in which the U.S. is represented in global rankings around the quality of our educational institutions. But there are times and there are ways in which it seems that some of the forms of support for the university as we have it, this mix of different kinds of things, different disciplines, different levels of education, advanced research, freshman seminars, doesn't have the same kind of support either from the government or from some of the public. Do you think we're going to be able to keep this system as strong as possible? I guess that's another way of asking, in effect, the same question. But I guess part of it, too, is to what extent is it precisely the way in which we teach these creative subjects, history, but also, you know, philosophy and English and literature and the arts, and have them right there next to the sciences?
For me, it's crucial to have these things all in one place, because I do think it really makes a very big difference, at least personally, to have that sense of this conversation going on across all these different domains of thought. I mean, I'm an optimist, you know, that eventually we'll find our way out of this current, at times, slightly anti-intellectual mode, and I'm assuming that there's, you know, a bit of a pendulum swinging, and eventually we'll get back to another period again where people will recognize that they want to build on this amazing university system that's been developed. Right now, I think it's a little bit harder to see, but I do have a sense that there is a strong understanding in, for example, California, that they actually do have something good here, and when it's, you know, ignited, I think it actually people really want to see it happen.
Another question from the floor. What big question do you want answered soon? This is feeling more and more like an oral exam up here, I think.
In our field, George and I, there happen to have been a couple of very exciting announcements in the last few weeks even that I think we're very much looking forward to seeing the answers to. One is this possibility that you can actually learn something about this primordial fluctuation, the original bouncing around that seems to have ignited what we now think of as the Big Bang. And I think it would just be remarkable if that turns out to be correct and we actually get a chance to learn something about that first fraction of a second of the universe that may tell us something really deep about how the world's put together, how it all works.
I'm taking advantages to motivate me because I'd just been in West Africa and I came back and got the terrible flu. And I was slowly recovering from it. And then the discovery was announced. And I dragged myself in to read all the literature and figure this out. And since then, with my collaborators, we've put out 3 papers. We think we have a good idea of how that things might have started. It's like you're on the trail of some great treasure you're going to find. It's really exciting when you're on that trail. It's only more exciting if you actually find the answer. And so the field is all stirred up. It's like the water is boiling everywhere because everybody knows if this turns out to be true, something is breaking. These kind of circumstances come along every few years and you just jump onto it and take it.
One big question. I would like to see Alzheimer's cured before it's too late. and there's quite great deal of promise, actually. So we'll see.
I was going to say, on that vein,
I'm actually fairly hopeful about cancer, although it continues to be a devastating disease, but in general, neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's being the principal example, remain a serious, difficult challenge. We just lost a colleague here in my department to ALS. He was at the peak of his strength 5 years ago, running, very active, and just withered away over 5 years, turned into nothing, and it was devastating to see him decay in that way, and we all have personal experiences of that sort, and yet there really is so little to do. That remains, to my mind, the greatest challenge in biomedical science.
We're going to bring things to a close, but we're just very grateful to all of you for joining us for the first Berkeley Talks, Thought Leaders in Conversation. This is a new series of events. It will bring international thought leaders, public scholars, creators, and innovators on campus to examine the distinctive issues of our time. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as we've enjoyed sharing it with you.
Randy Scheckman is a professor of molecular and cell biology who won the 2013 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine for his role in revealing the machinery that regulates the transport and secretion of protein in our cells. The discovery led to mass production of valuable drugs, including insulin, for treatment of diabetes. Saul Perlmutter is professor of physics and faculty senior scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and he led one of two teams that simultaneously discovered the accelerating expansion of the universe and was awarded the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics. George Smoot is a professor of physics and an astrophysicist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He led a team that obtained the first images of the infant universe, findings that confirmed the prediction of the Big Bang theory. He won the 2008 Nobel Prize in Physics. Daniel McFadden is a professor of economics. He won the 2000 Nobel Prize in Economics for his development of statistical methods that related to economic theory of discrete choice. His research changed the economic theory connected to both individual decision-making and large-scale public policy. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.